there is that sustained general strike, it's going to require a level of community solidarity or organizing alongside of it, you know, in tandem, so that you have folks who maybe aren't, who are already in that reality of not being able to spend, not being able to afford education, are able to get their needs met by their fellow community members and their I guess to create a network that can sustain a long-term protest while also meeting the needs of all those people who are stepping out of work.
Thank you very much for
calling in. We've got we've got 30 seconds left here tonight, we promised time people flew. We were going to tell. I know it did, and we also promised everyone we were going to tell them about Trump's new pick for Labor Secretary. Who is this?
We have a man named Alexander Acosta. He was part of the Bush Justice Department, George W. Bush, and he's almost scarier than Puzder in the sense that he is a true political operative. He knows how to run a bureaucratic operate within a bureaucracy,
right,
and to still do the bidding of a anti-government agenda. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure he will get nominated because the fight everyone put up against Puzder was so strong that they likely won't be able to knock him down. But we're gonna have to keep our eye on him because he is almost a bigger threat than Puzder was.
Look him up. Read about him. We're out of time for tonight. We'll put some stuff up on the website. We've never done this before, you and
Let's
I. We'll do this one. You'll have to go to kboo.fm/laborradio. We probably won't have it up tonight, but we'll figure it out and we'll get it up there soon. Yeah. You'll want to know about this guy, and we'll need to mount a resistance to him as well.
Absolutely.
And thanks everyone for listening. This has been Labor Radio, and we hope you have a wonderful evening.
Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding the institution of incarceration. We're here this evening with attorney Amanda Shemkiss. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about your background and your participation in doing different aspects of legal support?
Yeah, so I have a background doing a lot of grassroots advocacy work, starting in the animal liberation movement, and from that expanded doing work with other social justice movements. And that led me into realizing the need that activists and frontline communities and other groups have for legal support that is grounded in solidarity and an understanding of what it means to be resistance movements. So I went to law school, and from there started getting much more involved in doing the legal support aspect of movement work. And that led me also to doing prisoner support work as I started to, largely with friends being indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and then from there expanded to doing other prisoner support as well.
That's great. On Prison Pipeline, we talk about all aspects of the criminal injustice system, prison industrial complex, mass incarceration. And of course, another striking aspect is political incarcerations. Of course, we could say all incarcerations are political in a sense, but there's also the difference in which somebody does something in which they are incarcerated for political beliefs and political actions. And, you know, you've done some amazing work around that. And I know you wanted to talk about a particular case of the Cleveland Four, which, you know, we probably have some listeners who have, maybe they've never even heard of it. So can you give some kind of detailed background into it? And then we kind of talk about maybe some of the updates, you know, with the case or what have you?
Yeah, sure. So the Cleveland Four refers to a group of activists who were, it comes out of the Occupy movement. They were involved in the Cleveland encampment of Occupy. And they were, you know, a group of young anarchists who were doing organizing work. And around the time that the Occupy encampment fell apart, a paid FBI informant kind of zeroed in on this group of people because, you know, they were the anarchists there hanging out. And, right. You know, they figured that that was who they would try and paint to be these extremists as part of Occupy. Mm-hmm. And this paid informant spent literally months and months with these young people, manipulating them in all kinds of different ways, giving them jobs, alcohol, drugs, trying to act like he would offer financial support to their families, giving them financial support, place to live, and a lot of coercion, manipulation, because this FBI informant also was had his own criminal history that he was trying to make go away with the government. And so he wanted to basically present to the FBI a case that they wanted, and manipulated this group of young people into a so-called terrorist plot to place explosives under a bridge. And those, of course, were fake explosives supplied by the FBI, an FBI-created plot. But then these people were indicted for this and prosecuted as terrorists, basically giving the government what they wanted in this post-9/11 era, where they want to literally craft terrorism prosecution so that they can justify a continued interest in this war on terror.
Sure. Can we just talk just for one brief moment, you know, about anarchists, about anarchism? Because we're at this place in time that is, well, perhaps things have changed basically from the early 20th century in a sense, as far as the way people understand our anarchism or look at it, around the time of the Trump protests, back to that time of the Occupy movement as well. A lot of arguments about what that is, what does it mean? A lot of it gets into these kind of trivial discussions around whether property discussion is nonviolence and so on and so forth, and the way that the state behaves around scapegoating the anarchists and kind of playing that off of the community. So can you just touch on that just for a minute before we get back into the case itself?
Yeah, so we definitely see how, you know, there's a history of anarchists being vilified in different ways. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with why these people were singled out in this situation. And, you know, as anarchists who were part of the Occupy movement, they were interested in doing things like food, not bombs. They're like on the ground working to take care of each other, creating a lot of community. And that's what they were doing as anarchists, was trying to build this community of support and solidarity, and helping others. And that, unfortunately, is oftentimes manipulated into these other ideas about what anarchists are. Yeah, of course, you have the debates about property destruction and different things like that. But we can also, you know, in this situation, look at that as well. You know, the so-called plot, you know, it was, you know, created by the FBI, but even looking at it in itself was, you know, plotting to blow up a bridge in the, you know, middle of the night when, you know, they were concerned about making sure that no one got hurt, no one was on the bridge. And so, you know, yet that's being called terrorism because a piece of, you know, steel and concrete would have been potentially broken.
Right, right. And then you have all these setup cases in the last few years, which we don't have so much time to talk about, but kind of the Brandon Darby case setting up some of the young anarchists. This is years ago now, but in here in Portland, we also had the more recent case of Mohammed Mohammed with the Christmas tree, and how there's all these kind of FBI shenanigans putting money and resources into kind of, I don't know, you know, these fake activist groups or fake activists, and then egging everybody on and then, you know, feeding the fuel of the stereotypes.
Yeah, I mean, we can look to it just like the long history of social movements in the United States. You know, one of the most common government tactics to destroy them is to divide people. Mm-hmm. And it's, right. You know, so we see that time and time again where people are picked out as who's going to be otherized and make the rest of the movement against them draw those lines and create divisions that end up being the downfall of movements. And you know, we need to look at that, study that history and how it continues to play out, and look at when the government tries to do things like that, instead of, you know, people backing away or criticizing others, instead it should be this reminder that we need to, like, circle around those people, support them, show that it's not going to be this thing that pushes us away.
Right. So again, Cleveland 4, case in point.
Yep.
What else can you tell us about the case?
Definitely. So as I said, they, you know, it was this FBI created scheme that these people were basically plugged in as the pawns in it. And they were successfully prosecuted as terrorists because of what they were looking at. They did, three of them took non-cooperating plea deals because it's, you know, when you're already charged with things like this and it's in the media, it doesn't go very well with juries. A lot of pressure to just take a plea deal. And so they all received sentences of around 10 years. One of them also, he decided to go to trial, ended up representing himself, lost, and also got about 10 years. And so there's all serving about a decade in prison, and then that's followed by lifetime supervised release. So being on probation for the rest of their lives. And the reason that's allowed is because of the terrorism enhancement on their case. Usually with federal convictions like this, it would be a maximum of 5 years for supervised release. But instead, because of that terrorism enhancement for, you know, things that these kids were pulled into at, you know, around 20 years old, they're looking at for the rest of their lives being on that government under the watch of that.
So let's just say we didn't have the terrorist enhancements. I mean, what would be kind of, you know, a normal charge for, you know, if that was the crime that was committed? We're talking about kind of a, like, arson?
The actual crimes had to do with weapons of mass destruction, and then the terrorism enhancement is on top of that. So that's what the underlying things were.
Okay. And the weapons of mass destruction, again, are like these plastic toys that were fabricated by the FBI, basically.
Yes, it was. And you know, they were able to put the terrorism enhancement on there because the prosecution, you know, with the backing, full weight of the government, argued that this was an act done to try and influence the government.
Right.
Which is a bit of a stretch when it's a bridge that's not the government.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, again, when we look at, you know, the legal documents are there, the court case is there, you know, we can look at all these things. We know that what we're talking about is fact. This isn't hearsay, right? So maybe it's a naive question, you know, but it's like, what is going on, you know, with the FBI that they think they can, you know, I mean, just to get away with, I mean, this whole thing. Because again, there's numerous cases of this, right? And whether it's infiltrating a mosque or anarchist community or whatever it is, you know, this is the pattern, and it's so volatile, right? And where is, this is kind of the main question, really, where's the accountability around that, though? I mean, you know, again, we've seen them get away with COINTELPRO pretty much. Nobody got really in trouble for that other than like a slap in the wrist on the 75 church committee hearings. I know I always bring it up all the time, but you know what I mean? Like, where is the accountability around these cases at all? I mean, is there anything?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the success that they've had with this is a testament to how successfully the government has created public fear around the word terrorism. Mm-hmm. It's basically become this like boogeyman word where you just throw out the word terrorism and the public will, you know, back the government doing mm-hmm. whatever it is they say they need to do to keep everyone safe. Right. And I think a big way to like push back against that is to break down that word, to like say like, you know, whenever they're using the word terrorist, like break it down, look at what's really being done and look at, you know, in comparison, what things the U.S. government is doing under the guise of peacekeeping. There's mm-hmm, a lot of, right. you know, the double speak, double talk going on there about who's defining what these words mean. And, you know, we have to look at it's when those in power are the ones who are carrying out the violence. They have all kinds of different lovely euphemisms mm-hmm, for it. But mm-hmm. when it's, you know, people who have lesser power trying to push back in a different way, suddenly they're called the terrorist.
So from a legal perspective, though, like specifically legalese here, I mean,
legalese.
I know, right? Is there, I mean, something in there that, you know, and of course they get away with whatever they want, apparently, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's the legal precedent for actually getting redress on issues like that? Or is there not really legal precedent anymore for saying you can't just, you know, get these young people, you know, college kids or activists yeah. or whatever, to just do these mock, you know, terrorist actions.
Yeah.
I mean, where is the line there, like legally with this stuff under the or judicial branch of government? You know, I mean, if that like yeah. I guess exists anymore or not, you know, under Trump, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, we can look at all kinds of things that the government should help be held accountable for, and obviously not. Like in the Cleveland 4 case, you know, we could look at that and say, clearly these people were entrapped. Mm-hmm. Like, even right. though, you know, maybe the government did all this, they should have had that defense. But it's, again, very difficult to take that before a jury. And there have been people in similar cases who've tried that. And it hasn't gone well with the jury. In this situation, one of the Cleveland 4 tried that. Didn't go well. The other three were interested in using such a defense, but didn't feel like they had the legal support needed to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's one way. There are also supposedly rules around how informants can be used, that, mm-hmm. But we also, you know, can see repeatedly how there's a lot of leeway in that. So it is very tricky. I'm sure there's other things I'm not thinking of that could be other legal mechanisms, but I think that something that's important to do is to not necessarily look to the courts and the government for the answer
right.
here, since right. they're the right. same powers
right. Right. Right.
carrying
right.
it out.
Totally.
And coming back to like looking at in our communities, what can we mm-hmm. do when we can very clearly look at this is the history of how the government operates, and we should be taking that into consideration in our organizing mm-hmm. and how we're going to push back and what we're going to do when these instances occur.
For folks just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and we're here with attorney Amanda Shimkus talking about political incarcerations in the case of the Cleveland Four. So it seems like part of the subterfuge with a lot of these kinds of cases over the years, just as you mentioned, is that you use the T word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just label it terrorist, boom. The public doesn't even think about it. Nobody cares anymore because you just basically use the word. It was like this, it's like this magic FBI wand at this point
oh, yeah.
to kind of use it, right? And it seems that, you know, part of the solution in a sense as far as public opinion or what have you, right? Putting the humanity back in these cases, right? So again, people forgetting that we're talking about these four young men. They have families, maybe their brothers, maybe their, you know, uncles, whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, all those different roles a person would fill in society that's productive and family, that they also have their own family members who might rely on them. They have a community that might rely on them and those kind of things. And so putting that back in there, I mean, you know, aside from just the case or whatever, I mean, like, who are these guys? You know,
yeah.
you know, we talked about them as these kind of Occupy activists or whatnot, but where can we put in a little bit more of a story there for them?
Yeah, they're definitely, I'm glad you brought this up because it's definitely very true that there needs to be a look at who these people are as individuals because, you know, mm-hmm. you can look at, you know, the terrorist labels on them, the now the inmate numbers, calling them prisoners and all this stuff, but you know, they are individuals. And in this case, we have Brandon Baxter, Connor Stevens, Doug Wright, and Josh Stafford. And, you know, they were young people who, you know, feeling lost in different ways at the time all this happened, but, you know, finding a community in Occupy, like I said, like doing things like wanting to feed homeless people and other things like that. And I've personally been working the most with Brandon because I've been representing him on some post-conviction issues. So I've gotten to know him better than I have the others. But, you know, getting to know him as an individual and, you know, intelligent, compassionate, funny person who, you know, has all kinds of things that he wants to do with his life. He wants to do work to help low-income people. He does artwork. He's been learning Spanish. He, you know, has a family who's, you know, continued to be supportive of him. He has friends that he stays in touch with, you know, all kinds of different things that, you know, it's just like any other friends we would have.
Right. Like anybody you would know, just, you know, in your community or at school or what have you.
Yeah.
And again, so that gets kind of back to like the charges, though, you know, when we talk about this whole, you know, but according to the FBI or whatever, right? It's like, you know, he's living this secret, you know, terrorist lifestyle or something, right? I mean, this kind of, again, you know, this whole, you know, the typical, like, you know, almost like boogeyman kind of thing here. And so can you talk about that, you know, as far as, you know, debunking, you know, the myth anyways, but I mean, what, you know, aside from just the charge, but like, I mean, you know, what is it that they really say that these people were doing, you know, that they didn't pretty much lead themselves, the FBI, that is?
That's a bit tricky because, like, they, I mean, it's not like they were doing anything for the FBI to have zeroed in on to say, like, oh, clearly they're headed this direction or something.
Right.
They were initially talking to the informant about stuff they wanted gear to wear at protests because of all the different violent tactics that police use. So it started as just, you know, talking to someone who had, you know, supposed connections to different kinds of, you know, resources like that, them wanting stuff to wear to protect themselves against the cops. And then it turns into, you know, the FBI being like, no, you want this stuff instead.
Right. Okay. So in other words, it's like maybe they're at the Occupy encampment. You meet some new people. You start chatting about your politics.
Yeah,
you know,
and I mean, they were, you know, expressing interest in things like, you know, we need to do more effective protests or like, you know, things like that. Maybe talking about civil disobedience or like minor property destruction type stuff, but nothing like what the government was, you know, alleging that they were predisposed to be involved in.
Right. Do you have any background on the kind of FBI side of things as far as like how is that recruitment kind of working on the ground? In Cleveland at that time, like, do we have the papers? Do we know kind of what their operations were looking like? I mean, it sounds like they were going around, you know, having conversations, just, you know, kind of this arbitrary kind of targeting of people in a sense, or what did that look like on the ground?
Yeah. So this particular informant, he just showed up at some of the, you know, final Occupy meetings in Cleveland and ended up talking to Doug, who is one of the Cleveland Four defendants. You know, and they met up a couple times, and then Doug asked Brandon if he wanted to come hang out. And it just started as this gradual thing with the informant having these, you know, conversations over dinner, him taking them all out to dinner, buying them food and being like, hey, I want to, you know, help financially support you all. And like, I want to help you get more resources, but I don't want my name on any of this. So just sketchy initial meetings.
So from there, apparently, just the whole this conversation at dinner escalated into, you know, the FBI augmenting the whole deal with a particular plot to do these things. And can we talk more about how that kind of developed, and also maybe if you know what comes from any FBI files about that as far as what they were doing?
Yeah, I mean, it really was months of the informant developing this. He was someone who presented himself as someone who buys homes, fix them up, and resells them. And so he was employing these people in doing that work. And so he would have them with him all day as they're doing work. He's, you know, telling them different stories, guiding conversations, keeping them out, you know, working for long hours so they're sleep deprived, sending them home with alcohol, doing all these things to put them into, you know, fragile mental states in a lot of ways, as he's, you know, has them with him all day, mm-hmm. and he's, you know, their boss, their source of financial support, and also, you know, supplying them with things like drugs and alcohol.
So when we break down, again, maybe this is just a totally naive question, we break down the FBI motive for doing this stuff. I mean, one thing that we do know, it's kind of easy to tell, right? It's to squash social movements. I mean, that's par excellence since, you know, late 1800s. Yeah. This has always been a thing. You know, Hoover got his start, you know, as this dorky file person, you know, and next thing you know, he's going after, you know, Emma Goldman and like Marcus Garvey and then, you know, all the Panthers and stuff later on. It's just like this whole pattern. So we know that. But I mean, when it comes to like, what is the motive? I mean, you're going to just find a couple of these random people. You know, I mean, in this case, it's not that they're even these big national organizers or something like that, you know, and just to basically, I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's ruining their lives as well as destroying communities and families. Yeah. So, but from the FBI perspective, I mean, where is the need to do stuff like that? I mean, where is that? I mean, you know, it's one thing that they're, you know, investigating certain things or something about social movements, but then to go in there and just pick people out like that, I mean, what do they say about it?
I mean, I view it as this need that the government has to keep generating terrorist stories so that they can keep basically profiting off of needing to do their so-called counterterrorism efforts.
Right, right, right.
And keeping in the public, you know, in the public sphere, keeping that fear of terrorism alive so that they constantly have that as their go-to. Right now, you know, we get to points where politicians can go on TV and use the word terrorism about anything they want. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they're going to have some level of public support behind whatever they want to do. And so they have to keep that active so that when it comes time when they want to use it for their own interest, that word is there and available, and they can look back at these examples and see, you know, be like, look at all this stuff we've done. Like,
right.
You know, we're saving the day. We're the heroes. Look at, we keep you safe. Right. We're going to do that again.
So it's like really this pathetic portfolio almost to be like, look, we busted all these people that we set up and we like fabricated all the cases.
Yeah.
This gets into kind of a last point here. That might be good for at least some listeners, you know, if you want to just touch on this a little bit. I mean, just very briefly, but this whole process of people, you know, inadvertently getting recruited, a lot of times they're young people in their 20s. In this case, we see a lot, you know, it's happening a lot to anarchists, you know, these days. I mean, it has historically as well, but of course, plenty of other targeted groups. And, you know, again, people throw around this idea of, you know, kind of security culture.
Yeah.
You know, you're meeting people at the Occupy encampment. What do you say? What do you not say? Who do you give your phone number to when you think they're a friendly person that you might want to organize with? I mean, what do you think in your opinion or just on fact-based? You know, where is that whole thing at?
I mean, I think, you know, we have an interesting thing to balance because when we're engaging in social movement work, we want to be welcoming to new people. Mm-hmm. We want to get to know people. We want to expand our circles. You know, we talk about mass movement building that requires getting to know more people and bringing more people in. But how I think of it is, you know, consider what actions you're engaging in. Different things have different level of risk, and the higher the risk is, you know, make sure you know those people better. There's some things that people might only want to engage in if it's with, you know, someone they've known for 10 years, and there might be other things you're cool doing with someone that you met that day. And so just kind of, you know, think through, you know, we talk about security culture as a way to keep our, you know, community safer from, you know, unwanted government intrusion in whatever form it may be. So just, you know, consider that, how public are the things that we're doing and how, you know, for the more clandestine stuff, that's, you know, should be a different level of security around it.
Right. And I mean, it'd be one thing also to say kind of like use common sense, but then it's also like with this FBI stuff, I mean, you know, you can have all the common sense in the world and they're going to, you know, find a way to, you know, make a new fabricated like best friend for you to you know, set you up, or a new partner in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
Like you know, some of the informants who have been people's, you know, husbands or wives. I mean, there's so many old cases like that when you do the research of COINTELPRO.
Yeah.
So when we talk about what some of those resources might be or ways to kind of find out more about the kind of things we're talking about, you know, the case, security culture, what are some resources you would suggest people to kind of take a look at? Websites, organizations?
Yeah, so I always encourage people to go to as many Know Your Rights trainings as you can. They're, you know, often offered by a variety of different groups and at different sorts of events, and keep up on as much of that security information as you can. For the Cleveland Four, really encourage people to go to their support website. It's Cleveland4Solidarity.org. There's also a Facebook page that's Cleveland Four Solidarity, and Twitter is at Free Cleveland Four. So go to those, like follow updates or more information about the case. There also are ways to donate online, because donations are super important for keeping mm-hmm. money on their commissary, so that they are able to stay in contact with loved ones and buy food and personal care products. They also have wish lists online that you can buy them books from, and their addresses are all also on there, so you can write them letters. And just really important to make sure that they feel remembered and they feel supported, because one of the best ways to fight back against the government trying to tear us apart is to, you know, push back in this way of showing that we'll take care of each other.
Right. Well, it's a lot to think about.
Yes.
And to process. And so people should check that out. And I think it's really important, that point you made of, you know, write to prisoners.
Yes.
For various reasons. And even if you're somebody who's a total naysayer about these kind of cases and stuff, why not at least, you know, try to find out what's going on with people and, you know, yeah. even ask them directly, you know, and find out what's up, because otherwise, you know, people are, yeah, they're just going to get the same, you know, bad media, you know, following, you know, in any of the kind of articles that come out talking about these cases, you know, and it's, you know, we're at a point where, you know, it's not, we're not at any stopping point, it looks yeah. like, with these kinds of cases either. So, yeah. So you've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs on KBOO.fm/Prison Pipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Want to thank our guest, Amanda Shemkis. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hope to have you back on soon. Talk yeah. more about thanks these so cases. Much. Absolutely. Anytime. Of course, our wonderful engineers, Danielle Parks. Have a great evening. We will be back next week with our wonderful host, Karen James, as well. Free them all and see you next week.